Your health controller, you should have in your packet a cover letter along with the proposed line item budget and a description of the 10-11 budget request for the Minnesota House of Representatives. In addition, I believe you also have the background information from the from your budget book, which describes the legislature, and which does include a listing of the various departments within the Minnesota House. Madam Chair,
I find that one. okay. One to continue.
Should I continue?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Madam Chair and members, before I get to to talk about the specifics of the 10-11 budget request, I do have some general comments about the about how the House of Representatives funding and staffing relates to the executive branch and to the overall general fund. I'm going to say this just in terms of context, because I think it's important as you consider the budget for the Minnesota House of Representatives that you also think about it in the context of the overall general fund spending. While general fund spending has increased over 50% since 1998, state government funding and Minnesota House of Representatives funding has remained essentially flat. The spending by the Minnesota House as a percentage of the general fund has decreased by 20% over the last 10 years. In 1998-99, the House spending was 0.23 of 1% of the general fund. 2008-2009, it had dropped to 0.18 of 1%. And there's another important factor regarding our funding. The appropriations to the legislative branch from the general fund represent virtually the entire source of funding available to us, whereas other branches of government, other units of government, do have other sources of revenue. We are totally reliant on the general fund. As the smallest branch of government by far, the legislature has very little flexibility to respond to funding shortfalls, except to reduce permanent staff funding. There's a chart on that at the back of the packet, which I will also refer to. The chart also will show that 92% of the House budget is spent on staff member staff salaries, member salaries, benefits, related expenses. House staffing, I'd like to compare that for a minute. House staffing compared to the executive branch. As reflected by FTE data, House staffing has decreased by 5.5% from 2003 to 2008. Over the same time period, executive branch FTEs have increased by 1.4%. Now, looking at just at that smaller time period, if we go back to 10 years, the same trend emerges. So I'm not just picking data. From 2001 to 2008, staffing in the executive branch did decrease by about 1.1%. Over the same time period, FTE funding for the Minnesota House of Representatives decreased by 9%. Again, 1% decrease to the executive branch, 9% decrease to the Minnesota House of Representatives. And that does not even include the reduction that we will be required to take for this next biennium. Madam Chair, members, I'd like to to call your attention to also to some of the items I mentioned in the cover letter for the House. In FY09, the House absorbed funding reductions of $1.7 million, which was 5.5% of our 09 appropriations. The request for 10-11 reflects an additional $1.8 million budget reduction, which is a 3% reduction to our base budget each year. This is on top of a 2.8% base budget reduction to the FY09. Total reduction from 09-10-11 would be a 5.8% reduction. One important and I found surprising fact when I looked at the appropriation request that we're requesting today, it is $378,000 below the original appropriation made by the Rules Committee and appropriated by the legislature in fiscal year 03. So from fiscal year 03 to fiscal year 11, we're actually dollar amount requesting less amount. I think in my cover letter I say below that was below the amount approved by this committee. That could be an error because I initially wrote this letter for the Rules Committee. It was less than the amount, so that is true, that was less than the amount approved by the Rules Committee and by the full legislature in FY03. I guess I confess I don't recall what the the State Government Division Committee did recommend during that year. To manage our budget reductions during the current year and through the next biennium, permanent and temporary staff will receive no cost of living increases, no pay increases, no salary increases of any kind. Our hiring restrictions will remain in place, and the 18 permanent positions that are currently vacant will not be filled. This is an additional 7% reduction in force to our permanent staffing. And again, this is on top of the previous 9% reduction in staffing that I mentioned. The budget that I'm presenting, and that was approved by the Rules Committee, provides funding for approximately 235 FTE positions. As recently as 2002, the funding complement was 280 positions. The proposed budget includes increased insurance costs or health insurance costs for members and staff and increased retirement costs for members as required by law. But I would like to say that these reductions are difficult to absorb and for us to continue to meet our mission to provide legislative capacity to meet the constituent needs to make laws and to importantly balance power with the executive branch. Deep reductions like these can certainly affect our ability to accomplish those things. I would like to turn to some of the, again, to reiterate some of the things that are not in the approved, in the recommended budget. To repeat, staffing levels, holding vacant or eliminating the 18 positions that currently are vacant. No pay increases for staff. Temporary staffing would remain at approximately current levels. Redistricting. There is no money in this budget proposal to provide additional staffing for redistricting. We know we have additional constitutional responsibilities to pass law after regarding redistricting. Those will have to be absorbed by the caucuses to provide that the advice and analysis on that issue. Our equipment expenditures for IT office equipment, many of those are delayed to future years. We do have nothing in the budget to get us by currently, but approximately $2 million of identified requests from departments and needs are deferred to future years. Out-of-state travel is eliminated from the budget. Year-round lodging for members, non-metro members, is restricted to the first year of the biennium. Legislator salaries have not been increased since 1999. This budget has no money for pay increases for House members. We are spending down our fund balance, just as we did in 06, 07. But we will maintain an amount that will be needed for safety reasons to make sure that we have some money for unforeseen circumstances. We're continuing to encourage voluntary leave of absence. That's included in this in budget, as well as other cost efficiencies are expected to maintain. The other assumptions in the budget, There's really just one that I'd like to mention, and that is the rent cost for legislative use of the state office building and the Capitol. This budget assumes that we will not get an additional reduction to our appropriation from the Department of Administration for this. Without an increase to our appropriation, we really can't afford to start paying rent costs now. The Department of Administration has historically provided the services and rent for and our services rent free. If another agency in state government had a big increase in rent, the executive branch would give them a change item in their budget to compensate them for their change in their budget. But in this case, the administration has done the opposite to us. They're not proposing to charge the entire rent of the building to the house. They were short some money, so they are trying to basically shift money to their budget from our budget to make up for part of the cost that they're experiencing. I'm sure they do have real costs, like all of us who have big cost increases, but it sort of struck a nerve with me that they're proposing to shift a portion of our money to them to pay for just a portion of the those rent costs. The amount seemed arbitrary, and certainly would be no way reflective of the entire amount of the rent that would otherwise be due to the legislative use of the state office building capital. I mentioned a couple of charts I have in the back. One is a spending by category, which shows the permanent member costs for permanent staff, member costs, and temporary staffing. And there's also a chart that shows the trend in permanent FTE staffing. And this does reflect the two schools down about 235, the amount that is requested in this budget. Madam Chair, members, I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Actually, at this time, Mr. Schweitzer, and just hold your questions, members. There's the two members who really want to make brief presentations on the parts of the Legislative Coordinating Commission that they're associated with are here now, and so I think you're just going to have to compartmentalize these things in. You're going to have to listen to them before you hear the LCC, and then we're going to get back to the House for questions. Okay. Representative Huntley and Representative Johnson are both here to talk about, and these are items that would be mentioned under the Legislative Coordinating Commission budget. You can do it. You're not on the same commission, so you can do it separately. Oh, I think Representative Johnson, you were the one. He was the one who had to get out first. Well, let's hear him first.
I have 3:30 back.
Oh, okay. You're all right.
Madam Chair and members, this relates to the Great Lakes Commission, which is in Minnesota, worked through the LCC. The Great Lakes Commission is a federally chartered group started in 1955. It has the 8 Great Lakes states and 2 Canadian provinces that border on the Great Lakes. And the 8 states, 2 provinces work on a number of issues: environmental quality, resource management, transportation, and sustainable development. And I've been on that since 1993 as a member. Minnesota has 2 House members, 2 senators, and 1 governor's appointee that are members of the Great Lakes Commission. If you looked at the basically, it's about $70,000 a year. $60,000 of that is for our dues to the Great Lakes Commission. Each state pays the same. And then we have about $10,000 for travel expenses. There's 2 meetings a year. Depending on our budget, sometimes not all the members get to go to these meetings because they just don't have enough money. This is the Great Lakes Commission gets a lot more. Their budget is like 10 times, or actually 8 times what the dues are. and so they're bringing in research money and other grants, most of which get funneled back to the state. So typically for every dollar Minnesota invests in its dues, they get $4 back in research money spread around the state, usually for environmental matters. This is a very critical time for the Great Lakes. The stimulus package has a lot of money in it for Great Lakes cleanup kinds of things on the border of Lake Superior. There are targeted money from Congressman Oberstar used to clean up toxic waste sites that are in the St. Louis River Basin. In addition to that, perhaps more important, the President Obama has just announced about a month ago that he would support the start of what's called the Great Lakes Restoration, which is an attempt to regenerate the environmental quality of the entire Great Lakes, and I think he's putting about, if I remember right, about $400 million into that, and that is a first step. There was a similar project done in the Everglades, which ended up, so the feds paid $8 billion to clean up the Everglades. So we're looking forward to being able to work with the President and with Congress. The real thing that the Great Lakes Commission does, in addition to getting grants which then go to the states, is to coordinate the activities of the 8 states and 2 provinces when they lobby on particular issues in Washington. And it's, as we all know in our part of life, it's very difficult to get 8 people to agree on anything, and it's even more difficult to get 8 states to agree on it. But we have a close relationship with the Great Lakes governor, and basically we never go to Washington for something that the Great Lakes governors haven't also endorsed. So there's a joint work, and the we have been very successful at doing things jointly in the past. Governor does have a number on this commission, and he is also very active in Washington, the governor, in terms of cleanup things and environmental things. One of my personal roles on the committee is, I mentioned transportation. A lot of the states simply look at the Great Lakes as an environmental issue. And for Minnesota, the transportation part of it is very extensive, so that's the key that we've done. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Do you do okay when the meetings are being conducted in French?
we actually had a meeting in Quebec, and it's funny that you brought that up, because the Quebec, when we have the meeting in the spring in Washington, we go to Washington and we go to lobby the legislators and senators. And I went around this year with the member from Quebec. And when we go into most of the offices, we go in there and say to the senator or the congressman, you know, this is the issue for the Great Lakes. This is what we think you should do. And then we go into Congressman Oberstar's office, and we say, well, what's happening with the Great Lakes? Because he knows more. But this year, the gentleman from Quebec and Congressman Oberstar spent about half the meeting talking in French, so I don't know what they were talking about.
I've had that experience with Congressman Oberstar. His French is better than mine. okay. Are there any questions for Representative Huntley?
Oh, Madam Chair.
I have a question. Yeah. Was there any time when we didn't pay these dues? Did we back out of it in some budget cutting time?
Well, it's not unusual for one or two states to be behind in their dues. And if you look back at the expenditures in fiscal year 08, they're $141,000. And that's because we were paying back our late dues, because we had paid about half the dues
for
3 or 4 years. But everybody, actually, I think every state that happens to be up to date, but I'm not sure that will continue in this year.
Okay. Any other questions of Representative Huntley? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Johnson. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to say a few words about the Mississippi River Parkway Commission and just give a brief overview of what it is and what we do, and then the funding concerns for next biennium specifically. So in brief, folks, members, and Madam Chair, the mission of the Parkway Commission is really twofold. One is to preserve and promote and enhance the resources of the Mississippi River Valley, and the second is to develop the highways and amenities of Great River Road. And for those of you who don't know, the Great River Road is a national scenic byway, and that's a federal highway designation and recognition that allows for applications for a variety of grants and so forth. And the Minnesota-Mississippi River Parkway Commission is part of a larger 10-state Mississippi River Parkway Commission that's been in existence since the 30s, and it goes from the headwaters of Lake Itasca down to the Gulf. The commission has its constituted, there's 15 members. I'm the current chair of the Minnesota-Mississippi River Parkway Commission. Senator Senjum was the chair before I, and as far as members of the commission, it's myself and Representative Davis and Senator Senjum and Senator Pappas, who represents the legislative folks, and there's another 11 members and 5 technical advisors in addition to the legislators. So our work is
there no requirement for a member to live on the Mississippi then?
Pardon, Madam Chair?
No requirement for a member to, members district, the Mississippi to go through a member's district at all?
No.
Okay.
Technical, that often seems to be the case. The what we do essentially is a couple of things. One is we provide that a unified communication channel for issues up and down the river in Minnesota. We provide technical support and advice for local communities who have questions, concerns that we're able to provide help to, whether it's via the DOT, the Department of Agriculture, and so forth. We also leverage resources. As I said, we're part of the Natural Scenic Byways Road, so we're able to leverage resources and partnerships largely through that. And then we also are certainly a point of synergy for tourism and the like down Great River Road. And it's estimated we generated around $8 million, or Great River Road did, and its amenities that just this last year in tourism. And that's according to the Department of Revenue indeed. With respect to funding for the next biennium, our 09 funding started at $69,000, and then after the unallotment, it came to $67,600. And what further funding reductions would do, generally, as far as impact, would slow the work of the commission. And there are a couple of areas of immediate concern. I'll just mention those. We do access federal grant funds, as I said, and there's a 20% state match required, as often the case with federal grants. Our current projection is that approximately 8 to 10,000 state match in fiscal year 10 is required to access the 36 to 40,000 that we've already have of approved FHA grant funds. So if our budget is reduced to 65,000, the impact would be less money from the federal government in that regard. 2009 is a special year for the Parkway Commission. I really want to make note of this because you're all invited. We're hosting the annual meeting of the 10-state Mississippi River Parkway Commission down in Red Wing. It's a very important affair. It's going to be September 24th through 26th. We'll be bringing in 100-plus commission and tourism representatives from our other 9 partner states. And our current operating budget isn't able to cover all the costs, so we're hoping for a little help in that regard, if at all possible. I know these are tough times, but we're looking at hopefully trying to come up another $5,000 to $10,000 to host this annual meeting of the Parkway Commission. As a frame of reference, last year the commission annual meeting was held in Iowa, and they received about $20,000 in special state funding to make the annual meeting go. I'm not expecting that, Madam Chair, but we're just wanted to bring that up as something that's forthcoming and that we're working to make as a good event for the state of Minnesota as possible.
Well, do you look at any kind of private sponsorship to help with this?
Yes, we're working with everybody we can to come up with some possibilities. Like the Red Wing Port Authority, I was just on the phone with them, and everyone is short on dough these days.
I was thinking of something like the Carlson Companies or something like that.
And we're going to pursue all those avenues, but...
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, we had you weren't there, so this may not be fair, but we had a bill this morning in government operations, and it came to local government for the Mississippi critical areas protection. I don't remember exactly even what it was, but it seemed their goal basically was to create or to preserve critical areas along the Mississippi, all through the metro area. Do you have any interaction with that group, or do you know how, if there's any?
Well, we do. One of our commission members is the National Park Service Superintendent Paul Lavovitz, and he's intimately involved in that issue of the corridor. So we haven't taken a formal position, as the commission has not, but we're certainly aware of the issue and the debate going on.
Okay, and then. Chair, there just I know that the DNR is going to be tasked with some rulemaking as part of that. So, to the extent that there's any overlap, maybe DNR could be one of the partners in funding as well.
Okay. Any other questions of Mr. Johnson? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, members and Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Tricep, back to you.
Madam Chair, members, I believe I finished my direct presentation, but I'm available to answer any questions that members of the committee may have.
Are there questions, Mr. Schweitzer?
Thank you, Mr. Schweitzer. I do have a few questions. I do specifically on the redistricting, for starters. You said that no additional staffing or additional expenses, and I'm wondering about the printers and the software. I believe that redistricting equipment is pretty technical and whatnot, and I'm wondering, if there's no need, are the caucuses equal in the equipment they have, and are they up to date since the last time redistricting was done, which was, you know, obviously 8-9 years ago?
Members of the committee, Representative Pepin, some of those costs are taken up by the LCC. For example, I think they may have the cost of some of those fancy printers. As I recall, the House side had 10 years ago, the majority caucus hired 3 people and the minority caucus hired 2 people, and we provided some type of computers for them. But I think the specialized printers were purchased by the LCC. So Greg Kubinger is here present. When he comes up, he might be able to shed some light on that as well.
I vaguely recall there was something about securitized access to the stuff that was being done in the GIS. We'll ask. Okay.
I can go after.
No, keep going.
So where to start here? I'm wondering, we've had some interesting discussions and maybe even some amendments recently about the cost of special session. So I think you'd probably be the best person to ask, what is the average daily cost? What would our weekly cost of a special session? Can you just give us a rough estimate of, say, what a day would cost?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I know today's floor session, there was discussion about the cost of a regular session, for example, which is different from the cost of a special session. But just want to make that point. But generally speaking, the cost of a regular session, if you were to have a shorter session, was about $118,000 per week. But that was for members per diem, members travel once a week, and temporary staffing. Now, the cost of special sessions typically are less than that, because by the time we get to special sessions, typically we have released all of the temporary all of the temporary staffing by then anyway. So the additional costs aren't quite as high. Also, in a special session, each one is different. I do have a spread. There is a very nice on the Legislative Library has a place there where it lists all the special sessions going back to 1776, approximately. I believe we've had six special sessions in the past ten legislative sessions, but the costs typically, frankly, are overstated. Typically, the newspaper prints what the maximum possible cost that it possibly could be, and it often never is, because special sessions, while they might be longer, typically the full members aren't here every day during session. They might be called in once a week, and there are some working groups putting together some items, and so the cost of a special session are typically much lower than the cost of a regular session.
Do you have, Mr. Schweitzer, do you have a number estimate? That I know that there's been several special sessions, but do you have any kind of a price, a range?
I have a spreadsheet back in my office that lists out those costs exactly, but I don't recall. But what they are, I'd be happy to provide that to the committee.
That would be great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schweitzer, I have a question about people who get direct deposit of their paychecks and also get paper copies of their pay stubs, and why they can't get them online. And I have to say that the question was brought to me by one of our staff people who is sitting between Philip and I.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, members, it is possible. Certainly, it's possible for us to do that if we were to make an investment into our Great Plains accounting system. Probably, the short answer is that we're not on the state system, so we're not, like the executive branch provides those. If we were to somehow compel all House members and all House staff to go to direct deposit, that would be one step forward. But we don't do that. Secondly, if we were to make an investment in our, like I said, in our Great Plains accounting system that provided for web access to House members and staff, that could be provided, we would have a small savings in like I said, envelopes and pieces of paper. We have to weigh that against the additional cost of the upgrade.
Couldn't we just instruct the Department of Finance to do it, whether it prints the checks?
Madam Chair, members, the House is not on the is not on the state system, on the state payroll or accounting system. We have our own system, so it would be up to us to do that, unless we went to the state payroll system, which is something that we have looked at in the past.
Okay. I still don't understand. Why, when you're issuing a check, can't you just issue a BCC, which is the, the statement?
Madam Chair, if I'm understanding you correctly, I mean, if you're talking about payroll, direct deposit payroll, yes, we do that, and we provide a copy of it to the employer, the member, upon basically as a courtesy copy. We could stop doing that. Yes, we could save money by simply stop sending those direct deposit advice slips to members and staff.
Okay.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. I was just a little bit puzzled by something you said, Mr. Schweitzer, because I do direct deposit and I still get that, like a pay stub in the envelope, but I do direct deposit.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's it.
Yeah.
That's the complaint. Even if everybody did 100% direct deposit, potentially you could still be doing that. Isn't that just a matter of saying no to the system? I mean, that's usually a command thing that you tell the system to generate that report or those documents, and usually it's just a matter of not doing that.
Right.
Just curious.
I'm sorry if what I said was confusing. Let me try it again. We wouldn't have to print out those direct deposits, those direct deposits were sent to members and staff. The money would still be in your account. Everything would still work. It's just that unless it's the other part of it, that unless we set up a portal with investment in the a module of our Great Plains Accounting System that would allow for that, you wouldn't be able to know if except by checking your checking account whether or not the money was in, and you wouldn't have a record of, you wouldn't be able to check your the other deductions that we made from the account. I'm still not sure I'm clear, Madam Chair. I'll be happy to give it another try.
People's minds are thinking about what we can do.
The follow-up question, I guess, if Mr. Sparks has any idea what kind of cost that would be, just to add that piece on to the accounting system.
I, Madam Chair, members, I know we looked at it one. I don't recall. I remember people talking about $10,000-$20,000, but that might be high. And
does the Senate do the same thing?
Madam Chair, members, the Senate has a very different system. They have a
why are we not surprised?
Some years ago they contracted with Lawson Software, and they have a custom built payroll and accounting system there, and their payroll is actually run by a third party. Their data and server to process their payroll is performed by a third party. The Senate staff would of course have to provide information via computer to operate it, but the House does it all inside that approach.
Could you get us a comparison of the cost of those two, or do we have to get that from somewhere else?
Madam Chair, I think the Senate would be willing to provide the information to you. I think if your fiscal analyst would ask them or some. I think it would provide information to the House. I'll be happy to provide data on the House side for our Great Plains accounting system. We spend about $7,000 for our licensing fee, and at times we have to do upgrades. Sometimes there's some smaller one-time expenses for that, as well as the staff to maintain the system.
Okay.
Right. Sure, just to summarize, the Senate hired an outside third-party contractor to build a custom payroll system, and then their staff collects the information and then sends it to yet another third party to run the payroll through this custom-built system for the Senate?
Madam Chair, members, I think that's overly complex, but let me try it again. They did contract, some years ago, they contracted with Lawson Software to develop a software program for their payroll and accounting system. But instead of them operating themselves, there is a separate company, not the Lawson, that hosts the software and their data on their site, on the secure site, and so the Senate employees would send information. That's my understanding of their system. Please understand they're another unit of government, and that's just from my discussions with some of their staff as far as my understanding of their system. An area I hate to testify about their operations.
Okay. Representative Dingell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schweitzer, would it be too much of a problem to have an opt-out of the payroll stub? If I decided I didn't want it and Representative Holbrook decided she didn't want it, I mean, would that be a big deal? Would that be more cumbersome, more time-consuming to do that versus maybe looking at a comparison to kind of to what the chair was saying about how much we may save by the upgrade?
Madam Chair, Ms. Bergen Bigham, we'll have to look at that and actually ask the payroll staff to see if there's a button for them to push to not print the payroll advice slip for that. But I'll be glad to look into that.
We could also do an opt-in. Okay. Representative Kiplin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question again, Mr. Schweitzer, and this nicely maybe gets off into some money issues and stuff, or maybe not. At any rate, is this budget that is being brought forward here using carry forward money, and how much of it is it using to meet this budget?
Madam Chair, Ms. Kiplin, members, yes. We are counting on using approximately $1.9 million out of our expected carry forward funds just to meet this budget. So we're using a portion of our savings to balance out our funding needs for the biennium.
And then, Madam Chair, how much would be left then in that account?
Madam Chair, members, the short answer is I don't know precisely at this point. We have approximately $1 million left in our carry forward account. But I'm anticipating, like the House, like all other state agencies, none of us really know how much money we're going to have left over after fiscal year 09. So we're certainly anticipating that we'll have more than enough added to the $1 million to provide for this funding during this period of retrenchment.
Oh, okay. Just in a second.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Schweitzer. I'm just looking at your memo, and I was comparing it to the governor's budget book. And you're asking for 59.8, and the governor's got 58.1. And I'm just wondering if you could explain what the discrepancy is, what the extra money over what the governor recommends is for.
Certainly, Madam Chair, members, the House is requesting the budget request. Is also, as stated in the letter, is a 3% reduction to our base budget each year. The governor recommended a 5% base reduction plus another 0.8% reduction for the in lieu of rent. So the governor is recommending a 5.8% reduction to this unit of the legislative branch of the government. But frankly, without more serious implications for the House and our ability to maintain our legislative independence to meet our mission, that the House Rules Committee authorized a budget with a 3% reduction.
Okay, thank you.
There was a bill in Delvaux today, I believe, that allowed fitness centers run by private entities to be in state buildings. Could we sublease part of our building to be a fitness center? Mm-hmm. Is that Bill is going through its way. I think I'm not sure there was any objection to it in government operations, but
Madam Chair, members, some years ago, the room downstairs in the basement where the current where the pages are it actually had a fitness center of some type operated by a private unit. So it has been done for that place. If the House chose to use that for that purpose, we would have to find a new place for the pages, of course. And in terms of precedent, the house, the barbershop also in the basement is a, I guess would be a precedent. Maybe not a good precedent, but they provide a very valuable service to house members and staff. It's a small amount. They do pay the house a small amount in rent.
They pay the house, not administration.
Madam Chair, that's correct. They pay the house, but the money is transferred to the general fund. So, unfortunately, the house is not able to spend that money unless you were to add a rider language that would allow us to do so.
Well, we might need to know how much money it is. But but administration. So, if we were to do a fitness center, would we rent the space? Or would the House rent the space, or would the... Or the Senate is just another option. Let's just look in the legislature. There are all kinds of...
Madam Chair, I guess I'm unfamiliar with the language, but I guess if we use the barbershop as a model where the vendor paid us a small amount in rent and we provided the space, that would be a model that would work and especially... And it would help our budget problem, again, if you would appropriate that money back to the House.
Okay. Then the other issue is what, and I remember this was discussed once. I just don't remember what the solution is. What about the press corps? Is that free of charge, or are they all renting space there?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. In the in the Capitol, there is an area set aside for the press corps. There is no contract regulating the use of that space. It's I guess squatters' rights. They've been there for a long time, and there's no contract for them that even allows them to use that space.
Okay.
Madam Chair, this is dealing, I guess, from Representative Simon. Is there a Damon's deposit of some kind that they have to pay?
Madam Chair, members, no, there is no Damon's deposit. They have sometimes complained about the lack of services, about lack of ability to access our internet, but we have declined to provide them services without a contract.
Do they complain that their cell phones don't work down there?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, not that I've heard of, but again, I was talking about the space upstairs of the Capitol.
Uh-huh.
As opposed to the basement level, the prep you're referring to. Yeah. I really don't have any information about that area. I think is under the control of the Senate or perhaps admin. So I'm not talking about that space.
Okay.
But Madam Chair, there is a question there, which is the fitness classes bill that you were talking about basically just created a requirement that everybody, both people taking the class and providing the class, would be waiving any liability against the state. I think that was basically what that bill did. So I think that would also go to the press corps. You know, they had to waive any liability for damage themselves from their occupancy in that space.
But there was no talk about who would pay for the fitness center. There's no talk of that.
No.
And there was no...
I think the idea was that maybe the staff could get together and have a yoga instructor come in sometimes, or, you know, psychiatric care for members, I don't know.
Yeah, so Madam Chair, we have some private businesses in the state of Minnesota. I won't name them unless I offend anybody by leaving them out. But you could go for bid and just have them bring it in and do that. But I think they could even have memberships, ongoing memberships. I mean, some folks may already have a membership. It's just a matter of facility to maybe make use of it. Anyway, I think it's a great idea. It'd be wonderful.
Okay. Let's see if direction. Any other questions of Representative Holder?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If our salaries are staying the same, why is there a $100,000 increase in members' salary as a line item from 08 and 09 to 10 and 11?
Madam Chair,
maybe you knew something we didn't know.
Madam Chair, from the Holberg members, the line items for members' salaries includes session per diem payment, members' session per diem. Sessions per diem are subject to retirement contributions.
interim per diem payments aren't. So because they're subject to retirement system, they're categorized in along with salary in our accounting system. And so they've historically been reported on that line.
Well, okay, Madam Chair, now I'm confused because I see members per diem in the second quadrant, if you will, and member salaries is the first line item on the...
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the second is the members per diem in the second quadrant is interim per diem payments.
Okay.
So the session per diem payments will be included in member salary in the first area.
All right, and you alluded to it a little bit about in the past, has the legislative branch looked at using the state payment system by contract? Or, I mean, is there any efficiencies? I understand the separation of powers issue, but it's, in some ways it kind of seems silly to have three different systems.
Madam Chair, members, about 3-4 years ago, we did a careful analysis of that. We ran into some kind of some problems that we weren't quite able to get around. One issue had to do with member salaries. Of course, members are paid 1 month in advance. The executive branch systems really aren't set up to accommodate that. One hurdle, which would be certainly possible, would be to have a change in statute that would set member salaries set the timing of those consistent with other agencies. A second hurdle that we found was data practices. That once we provide data to the executive branch through payroll, all that data would become public information and disclosed in any way that the executive branch chose to. Currently, the executive branch, the legislative branch, is not covered by the Data Practices Act. Although we generally comply with it, but generally speaking, that was a concern of legislative management, of what we wanted to have to provide data to make that data public. There were some other issues that we also had concerns about in terms of timeliness of providing payments to members and staff. I'm not entirely sure that we could meet the current level of service that members and staff are currently getting, but it could be done. There already is statutory authority through the Department of Finance that would require them to process our payroll if we requested them to do that. So the statutory authority to do it is that piece is in place, but there are some of those other several other hurdles that we would have to overcome.
Right, and members, just we talked a little bit about the pay stubs, but I don't know how many members are not happy about signing a phone bill for 1 cent and a piece of paper, and current law requires that every single member receive their phone bill, sign it, and the vendor cannot be paid until Jesse has all 134 signed slips back in his possession. For those little phone bills, and that's in statute, and Representative McNamara has had a bill for a number of years to negate the need to do it if it's under $5 or something. So if members want to get rid of something that's really inefficient and waste a lot of a staff member's time, there's one real easy one that can be done. I think it grew out of PhoneGate, and the chairwoman may be able to confirm that, but just every member signing off on every phone bill, even if it's just a penny, takes up a lot of time.
Okay, let's put that on our list. I don't see any of these things getting up to millions somehow. But we'll see. We do have to go on to the rest of the LCC. So any other questions for Mr. Schweitzer? And we do have some follow-up things for Jenna Tevin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Schweitzer, could you just describe the maintenance and repairs? Any new remodels? Or are they just fixing?
We're putting a seal.
We're going to put a seal in this rug. The Senate has them, the governor has them, the attorney general has them. We're the only ones who doesn't have seals in all our rooms, or some of it.
Actually, to save time, perhaps you just want to email them or something?
Very quickly, Madam Chair, members, I can hear that. In FY10, the amount is $241,000. Of that, approximately, it looks like $95,000, which is for copy machine, I say maintenance. We pay a quick charge on all of our copy machines. For every time you run a copy machine, we're charged between 0.003 cents and 0.08 cents per 0.008 cents per copy. So all that adds up with all the paper that we produce here. Other expenses relate to some other computer maintenance agreements and things like that. Very little is plant management just charges for things like keys and some building maintenance items. And some equipment and furniture repair costs. When a member chair breaks, when the wheels break on the chamber, we fix it, and that's included in the estimates.
So we could have a surcharge for members based on their weight.
You didn't have to answer that.
Oh, well, maybe it's just the aggressive way that they move it. And you don't know who is sitting in it besides you. Okay. All right. Okay. Going to the LCC. Mr. Hoobington.
Yes. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. I'm Greg Gibbinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. For the new members, the LCC is a joint House Senate commission made up of the leadership of both houses. It includes the Speaker, the Majority Leader, the Minority Leader, and three other members, including Representative Holberg, and then their counterparts from the Senate. I think each of the directors is appreciative of the opportunity to provide an overview of their offices to you today and talk about their budget proposals. I'd point out that under our statute, the LCC is to review and approve the budgets before it's submitted to the finance committees, and the LCC has not yet met to do that. The joint legislative offices comprise a relatively small but we think important part of the legislature. We employ about 135 staff compared to 209 in the Senate and about 235 in the House. Our annual budget is $16 million or so compared to $24 million for the Senate and $31 million for the House. So our budgets comprise about 22% of the total of the legislature budget. I believe you have a packet in your materials from our offices. It's on the first page of that is a budget summary which shows each of our offices, the 08 expenditures, the original 09 appropriation, the FY10 base, and then the governor's rec for FY10 and 11. The governor's rec, like for the House, is a 5% reduction for each year, and then another 0.3% reduction in recognition of rent. This may be more from Ms. Roberts than anyone else, but the budget book by the Department of Finance for the legislature on page 14, the Department of Finance allocates all of the reductions, that 5.3%, to the operating budget of the LCC alone. I'm not sure if the governor is trying to send a signal to our office, but I'm told by the Department of Finance staff that they applied it to our office for administrative ease, and they intended for the legislature to allocate those reductions. The joint offices are operating under the same rules as the House and the Senate. We have a hiring freeze in place, with exceptions having to be approved by the LCC chair, who is the speaker. We have a salary freeze in place, and we also have no out-of-state travel unless specifically authorized by the chair. Like the House and Senate, our 09 operating budgets have been reduced during the course of this fiscal year. In the original appropriations bill in 2007, there was a reduction to our budget, like the House and Senate. There was also in the 2008 appropriations bill a 1% reduction to our base. And then in earlier, or in late 08, like the House and Senate, we responded to the governor's request that we unallot some of our funds. The House and Senate each unallotted $800,000. The joint offices unallotted $600,000. As a result, if you add those reductions up, our budgets for FY09 have been reduced by about 5%. We are developing our proposed budgets based on the premise that there will not be any salary increases in FY10 or 11, and we're using the same assumption as the Department of Finance in assuming that health insurance premiums for all state employees will increase by 6% each calendar year. Our plan is just to have each of the directors come up and walk through their budgets, and we're going to follow the list as they, in the order that they are in the budget summary. And so if there aren't any questions at this point, I turn it over to Michelle Timmons, the reviser.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Michelle Timmons, the reviser of statutes. And Mr. Huebinger asked me to give a little bit of an overview of our office. And I think all the members are aware of what the office does with respect to the drafting of legislative documents and the quality control that we provide for the bills, the engrossments, the committee reports, conference committee reports, side-by-sides, enrollments. So I'm not going to talk about that very much. I think you're aware of that. I do want to point out, though, that we do have one new service that we're providing this year, and that is that the conference committee reports are going to be posted to the web by the reviser's office. It's always been the protocol that the signature sheets are returned to the reviser's office, and so we are now starting to put those on the web, which gets them out there at the earliest possible time. We've also altered the header of those documents, so it will tell you exactly when the conference committee report was posted, both time and date. And we've got it set up so you'll automatically receive an email when those conference committee reports are posted. So we've only done one so far under this new system, that House File 392 on Green Acres, but you all should have received an email. And that tells you when it was posted, and it also creates a link to the text of that document. And part of my reason for raising this is that it's one of the cool new things we can do with the new revisers computer system, which this committee heard a lot about over the last decade that I've been reviser. And I'm pleased to let you know that except for a few things regarding the court rules, the system is fully developed, and we were able to unplug the mainframe we purchased in 1971. We did that in June of 08, so last summer we were able to unplug that. And as you know, the Extend bill drafting system is really used by the whole legislature. So House Research, Senate Counsel, and the House and Senate desk operations use that central computer system that we've developed. The bill status system that you see on the web was completely revamped and reprogrammed last summer to try to create some smoother operations. And we've also worked on a lot of cooperative efforts with the House and the Senate staff to better integrate computer operations at the whole legislature. And as a result of that, the reviser's office has taken on some additional central roles. For example, the networks, the core networks that make the new VoIP telephone system work are now being managed by the reviser's office, although pieces of the system are still managed by each entity. And similarly, the central networks for the wireless we've taken on. So we have a growing, continuing to grow in that central computer service area. For the third main key area of the revisor's office is the editing and publication work. And that is often hidden, but when the legislature is done during the interim, we spend a lot of time looking at what passed, editing first the laws, then integrating all those into the statutes, applying all the revisor instructions, and we are the official publisher for the laws, the statutes, and the administrative rules. And we're working cooperatively with the courts on the court rules as well.
Okay, Representative
Folger. And just real quickly, with your new conference committee report, at what point are you going to post them? When you have a majority of signatures on both sides? Or
correct.
So we'll chase around and try and get signatures in order to get them up on the web.
We need those signatures back, and, you know, we'll be busy doing a lot of other things. So if the committee chairs and staff can help get those signatures, but we won't be posting them until we have the required majority of signatures of both bodies.
All right, thank you.
You bet.
Okay, that's been a good time.
Well, Madam Chair, if you have a question, you go
first. Okay. Yield it to you.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I had was, when I print out some of the, when I try and do a letter size, and I know you've done so many improvements and done such great things, but it's really odd that in this one area, the line numbers are mushing and not coming out right and some of that stuff. And so just wondering if that's maybe a little glitch, or if it's just the awkwardness of going to an 8x10 paper instead of legal size. Maybe it's not even your issue. Maybe it's somewhere else.
Well, let me add to that.
When are we going to
ban the legal size
by 11, right?
Right. Require everything to be on 8.5 by 11.
Madam,
answer both of them.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, and members. Okay.
Yes.
I think right now the legal size, at least when I print it off on my machines on the letter size paper, it more or less shrinks it to about 75% size, and I'm not having that problem. But I'll report that to my computer staff, and perhaps we can investigate it and see what that particular issue is. And then as in regard to the broader issue, the 8.5 by 11, I think we had some good conversations last summer with the House and the Senate about changing the bill size to 8.5 by 11 paper, which would hopefully alleviate the kinds of problems you're talking about. And we would have to do some things like redesign the covers. There's programming that would need to be done, and we've done just some preliminary studies about the cost, whether we would actually save cost. And my office analyzed it that for bills less than 10 pages, it's probably actually more expensive to go to the shorter paper. But once you reach that tipping point of 10 pages or more, then because of the fact that the smaller sheets are much less costly, you do save. But now House analysis, when they looked at the clip charges of more, you know, if you're making paper copies, you add more clip charges if the document is longer. So they weren't necessarily seeing a lot of savings. So, you know, I think we need to have further conversation. But I guess the good news for you, Madam Chair, is I think we do have agreement that we are going to have that conversation and seriously look at this. And
who objects most?
Well, well, part of it is, the issue of, are we really going to save any money? I mean, that's a legitimate question, a legitimate analysis. There are some people who really like the amount of white space that's on the longer paper. And so, I mean, some of it is what you're, I think some of it is what you're used to. And the fact that the covers on the bill jackets do serve a purpose, and there's a lot of information on there, and there is a concern about that. So,
Okay. We do need to move pretty quickly. Any other questions for the revisers? Oh, you're not.
Madam Chair, how much money do you save by publishing the 2010 statutes in soft cover?
We're estimating about $60,000, and that would just be in 1 year. So that is one of the program line items that we plan to reduce. Along with another good thing we can do with the computer system is rather than having an outside contractor compose that data and lay it out on a page to be printed in a book, it's now much easier to do that in-house with our new system, and that should save about $45,000 a year.
Okay.
So we'll be cutting some of those program line items. Also, some of the computer line items, although there's a limit to how far we can go there because of the fact that we do provide such central services now, and it affects the whole legislature. And then we'll be continuing to hold an 11% vacancy to try to manage a 5.3%.
What about this line on the contact the recipients of free sets and require a frame of request before printing? Does that include the legislative members too?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I think actually this suggestion has been made for a couple of years, I think, in this committee, and we've always been contacting people. We intend to do more of a direct survey, directly contact members, and provide more of an opt-in system so that we try to reduce the numbers of free sets. The legislature gets a little over 300 for the House, maybe about 175 for the Senate, but there's a total of nearly 1,800 free sets that we produce. So if we can reduce some of those, that will help reduce costs for those publications.
I think the problem, nobody seems to remember ever being contacted. Oh, you were? Okay.
Chair, I think we're contacted for, like, copies of the journal and other things. Not yet for the statute,
yeah,
but I think
no.
What she's talking about is that she's...
Yeah.
But I'm curious, who do we give the 1,800 other free sets to?
Oh, there's about 100... to the University of Minnesota. There are a lot of other law libraries. There's the courts is a very big segment of the free sets. It's mostly entities that either are other main governmental recipients or libraries that help provide public access.
Do we provide them to the prisons?
No, not to my knowledge.
Probably one place we should.
I believe the Department of Corrections provides them to the prison.
Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, and I would assume, and that's always dangerous, but given the amount of people just around here that no longer use their books and do all of their access online, that's probably reflected in the courts and in other, at the university, et cetera. So, I mean, I would hope that with this affirmative asking for them, or maybe even having a slight surcharge or something, that we might be able to severely reduce the number of free sets that have to go out.
Put a price tag on it, and it will.
Okay, right. Okay. Anything else you need to tell us?
No, Madam Chair, that concludes my remarks. If there are any other questions.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Noble.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Jim Noble from the Legislative Auditor, and I know you have a lot of organizations to work through, so I'll try to be brief. I would like to just note for the record, since the topic came up, that the Office of the Legislative Auditor has for many years been a part of the state's payroll system, and we do not provide the paper deposit data like that. This system works very well. I invite you to use it. We are also subject to the Government Data Practices Act, unlike other legislative offices, and that works well fine as well. We also pay rent because we're in the Centennial Building, so that is already a part of our budget. I think the important message that I want to give you is to simply remind you that as a result of the budget cut back in 2002-2003, the Office of the Legislative Auditor had significant staffing reductions. I would refer you over to the, I think you have this document with you that Mr. Kubinger provided. And if you notice, under the Office of the Legislative Auditor, back when we are sort of using as the baseline complement, we had a staff of 79. We currently are trying to maintain a staff of 62.
Yeah.
And frankly, I don't know that in my lifetime we'll ever get back to where we were. And so we are always working with the premise that that will be our complement, and we will attempt to complete our mission with that level of staffing. And I think we also are presuming that we will probably work with a budget something in the range of what the governor is recommending, and that's what we will try to manage too. We, as has been mentioned, have not really gone through our budget preparation process through the Legislative Coordinating Commission. But just as I say, going forward under a presumption, we assume that we will need to work within the governor's reduced budget recommendation, and we think that we can accomplish that. Well, it'll be more difficult, obviously, taking a reduction on top of the staffing cuts we've already incurred in recent years, but that's the presumption we're making. So, Madam Chair, with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for the legislative audience?
Thank you.
I think we're behind on not having your latest report before us, but we'll try and get that in at some point. The finance department.
Madam Chair, I just have a question. Do you have a seal on the floor in your office?
Oh, Madam Chair, I do not, and I never will.
Okay. 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 Legislative Reference Library.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Robbie LaFleur, Director of the Legislative Reference Library. Thank you for having me. I love to talk about the library and its services and collections, but I'll be brief in my overview and roughly follow the points in your handout. I'll talk a bit about how we're planning for budget cuts and give a bit of an overview for the members who are new to this committee and new to the legislature. And then I'd be glad to answer any questions about the library or our budget. The library celebrates its 40th anniversary this year, hence the logo in the corner of the handout. There have been huge changes in technology, but the mission to provide the information resources needed by the legislature has remained unchanged. So briefly, what do? We answer questions. Many of you take full advantage of that, but even if you don't call personally, I'm sure we're helping the staff members who serve you. We help citizens access legislative and public policy information on the phone and through the website and in the library. We average about 300 questions a month coming in via the website and more during sessions. Our collection of print and electronic materials is focused on state public policy issues and on the current and past and present of the Minnesota legislature. We track all of the important studies and reports that are required by the legislature each year. We house legislative history materials. I'll just point out that people who are forced to do legislative history research are among the crabbiest people who come to the library, and when they're done, some of the most grateful patrons. We're the state depository for documents from state agencies. We keep them in print, and since 2003, we've been archiving all the documents we receive electronically. This ensures that many years from now, even if an agency doesn't exist or an IT person has erased whole directories of documents, they'll still be available. I can talk at length about the value of state documents and mandated reports, so if anybody ever wants to hear, just let me know. We have a terrific periodical collection of magazines and newsletters and provide custom alerting services so that members and staff can track individual titles or get things by topic. These services have become completely web-based and much more interactive in the last year. We also pay for electronic access to magazines and newspapers for the entire legislature. A good example of this is our subscription to NewsBank, which is how you get the full text of the Star Tribune Pioneer Press archives on your desktop. We publish the joint main pages of the legislative website and house them on the library servers. We coordinate the activities of LNET, the group of legislative staff from the House, Senate, and joint offices who create the really great legislative website. We track the activities, controversies, issues, and accomplishments of the legislature over time with print and electronic files of articles, reports, and clippings. We publish legislative statistics, including data on special elections, caucus strength, and vetoes over time, and special sessions back to 1776, as Paul pointed out. We maintain a database of all legislators since territorial times, our legislators' past and present database. In the past year, we've also created two new databases. We've put all of the executive governor's executive orders since 1967 in a searchable database, and we are starting to collect all of the SONAR, the statements of need and reasonableness that are created in the agency rulemaking process, and keep those electronically. The budget cuts represented in the governor's budget will present a significant challenge, but there are things we can do. We can defer most hardware and software purchases for about 2 years at the most. Our successful hardware acquisition has been helped tremendously by falling technology prices and by donations from other legislative offices. The servers and workstations that we purchased in 2008 were half the price of those that we purchased in 2002. Just this past year, we've managed to catch up with all of our hardware and software since the cuts of 2003. So now we're positioned okay for the upcoming biennium in that category. However, we do face challenges, especially in document file storage. We've converted our paper-based services to electronic delivery. Some legislators and staff still want paper, but the rate of switching over is increasing all of the time. We can cut our training budget by 80%, but that's only $5,000 to $1,000. We can be very creative in finding savings in several categories of our budget, but the reality is that while that helps, the salary line is the hardest to change. It's the staff who build and maintain our services and the institution. We laid off two staff members in 2003. However, with restructuring and the efficiency that comes with technology, we've been able to maintain a high level of service. But I'll do my utmost to avoid further layoffs. Depending on the level of the ultimate budget cuts and depending on how we can manage significant costs of severance in the first year, if we have to get to that, we'll have to make hard decisions in the coming months. I have high hopes that several staff members will take significant salary savings leave, and that will really help. I'd be glad to answer any specific questions about the library or a budget.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question, but just a comment. Going to the electronic just in and articles, and that's huge. And we as legislators feel overwhelmed by paper at times, and I for one am very grateful for the option to get all those things electronically, so thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other folks have addressed salary increases and steps and things like that. I don't recall, maybe you did say something, but is your library personnel going to receive any pay increases or steps or anything?
No, it's the same as the rest of the legislature and LCC. No, there are no increases or steps or...
Sure. Maybe you said it and I missed it.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Martin.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Larry Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions. I'm going to try and be the briefest today. The Pension Commission basically has three functions. It serves as effectively the joint pension subcommittees of the legislature during the course of the legislative session. It assembles the omnibus pension bill each year. During the interim, it works on either topics that were left over from the prior session that were not resolved, or pursues and develops our legislation for the upcoming session in the area of public pensions. And then a third duty that was added to the Pension Commission's tasks last session, the chair is actually the author of the bill that did it, a reviewing and auditing actuary was added to the Pension Commission, and we are in the process right now of reviewing the proposals from the RFP. The auditing actuary pursues or monitors the actuarial work done by the pension actuaries retained by the various public employee pension funds to determine their adherence to standards, to statutory requirements, and good practices. The way that the Pension Commission is likely to meet whatever budget our reductions come out of this session will be in structuring or restructuring the contract with the our consulting actuary who will be retained to perform the auditing functions. There probably wasn't enough money in the money that was redirected from a public pension state aid program to actually do as thorough a job as might have been anticipated, and reductions will provide even less thorough, which will mean more infrequent reviews than might have been optimal. But that's the way that the Pension Commission, as I see it, will likely handle the out of budget difficulties.
Is there an ability to charge a percentage of the pension funds, the money that we might require to do this?
Madam Chair, that was not part of the piece of legislation. Money was provided, an additional amount of money was provided to the Pension Commission by reducing the state aid that otherwise would have gone to one of the public pension plans. So there would be presumably some controversy in not only recouping that state aid for a different purpose, but also charging for the same service. But that was not part of the piece of legislation in 2008.
Okay. But this is an ongoing expense.
Madam Chair,
so one can still access the same state aid fund for the ongoing expense.
Yes,
right?
Madam Chair, the
would that require new legislation? Was that permanent?
A reduction in permanent add-on to the base of the Pension Commission's budget.
Okay. So that's good. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer questions.
Any questions of Mr. Martin? Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Representative Mason, we have before us the minutes of March 31st. Representative Mason moves adoption of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passed. Okay. Gubinger.
Madam Chair, Greg Gubinger. I'd like to go through the next three budget lines and spreadsheets that relate to the LCC.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, in your handout on page 5, there is a list of responsibilities for the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Those are bolded. I'd just highlight a couple of them. A primary responsibility is to provide oversight and coordination for all of the joint legislative offices and to provide fiscal and payroll services for the joint agencies. Our office is responsible for preparing fiscal notes on bills that affect the legislative operations. We provide GIS and other mapping services to members, and every 10 years we gear up and help support the legislature during the redistricting process. We also provide policy support on legislation affecting the economic status of women. And then in the middle of that page, we provide staff and fiscal support services to a number of working groups and task forces and subcommittees that are listed there. If you were to look back at page 2 of the packet that Mr. Nobles mentioned earlier, that shows the staffing levels for the various offices, you'll see that in 2003, the LCC had 12 some staff and currently have 8. And so we've gotten substantially smaller in the last several years. One of the ways we've managed that reduction is to become much more efficient. And one of the primary ways we accomplished that was by moving to the statewide accounting system. So the joint offices rely on the executive branch's system. It works quite well for us. All of our pay stubs are available online. There is no paper. Legislative members who serve on commissions and task forces that are paid through our office have their per diems and expenses paid through the statewide payroll system. And it works just fine. One of the other ways that we have responded to reduce budgets in the past is by consolidating functions. We used to have a half-time person that was dedicated to dealing with foreign delegations that were coming to visit the legislature. And after 9-1-1, the number of those folks coming has been substantially reduced, and so we eliminated that position, and that function has been absorbed by another staff person. We also have responded to this to reduce funding by relying on temporary or student workers. And they're great staff. Unfortunately, they turn over a lot, and so we have a lot of training that we have to do. For the LCC, the governor's recommendation of a 5.3% reduction would mean that we would need to continue our current vacancy rate and continue using the student workers. As has been mentioned, we would be freezing salaries for the next 2 years. We'd have less funding available for employee development. And it, like some of the other offices, we would have to delay or defer expenditures on hardware and rely on our carry-forward account. I think there was some mention earlier about the redistricting process that will happen during the beginning of the 2011 session. Typically, the Legislative Coordinating Commission requests and receives an appropriation of one-time funding to support the legislative effort and for redistricting. And that funding is used to buy the hardware and software that is used by each of the caucuses. We're assuming that money is not available. Our office has, I think, about $150,000 of anticipated expenditures for some of the specialized hardware and software. We've told the budget staff in the House and Senate about what they need to expect in terms of what they would need to purchase for the caucuses. The most expensive item, I think, is the plotter to produce the large maps that are required. Those are about $11,000 a piece. So we're anticipating that we'll be absorbing those costs. The next line in the budget relates to the LCC other slash fiscal agents. This is sort of a hodgepodge of appropriations that where the legislature appropriates money for pass-through. This is where we pay for the cost of the legislature's membership in NCSL and CSG. This is where we pay for the legislature's use of sign language interpreters for legislative hearings and meetings with people who are deaf or hard of hearing. We contract with their services with an outside vendor. And then we have a small contingency account in this part of our budget where we pay for unanticipated expenses. Half of that is committed now to paying for the legislature's membership in the legislative forum, for the forum where the members from Minnesota, North and South Dakota, and Manitoba get together once a year. And this is where we pay for some of the costs for the unfunded task forces that get created at the end of session to study issues. The third category that I was going to mention is the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. It's a 10-member commission, five House members, five Senate members, and this group meets typically during the interim to review and approve, provide interim approval of state labor contracts. That appropriation pays for parts of two staff people and then the per diems and expenses for the members. We continually try to manage that budget by coordinating the meetings so that we can bunch up the labor agreements as they come in. There's a law that says that the subcommittee has to meet within 30 days of a contract being settled, and so we have to do some finesse arrangements with the Department of Finance around that, but they've been very helpful with that. That's a quick run-through of our budget. There's one more budget, Madam Chair, for legislative TV.
Okay. Any questions of Mr. Speaker?
Regarding legislative TV, I'm just curious about the preamps and how many we have, how often is it? Am I the wrong person?
This is a great one for that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Barry LeGrave, Director of Health Public Information Services, and we're in the second year of our contract with the Minnesota Public Television Association. I don't have the exact number here, but I think we have about 17 or 18 preemptions left for the rest of this legislative session. And the preemptions are when we can provide programming on the on our broadcast channel past 6 p.m. So we use that for high-profile events, floor sessions, hearings.
Thank you.
Just a real brief, Madam Chair, as Greg indicated, they're a fiscal agent for the Legislative Television Distribution Fund. LCC's appropriated money that we use for to establish broadcast contracts. As I indicated, we broadcast statewide on the Minnesota Public Television Association's digital Minnesota channel. We also use those funds to establish a contract with closed captioning services. All the programming as a broadcast is closed captioned. And so House Public Information Services and Senate Media Services produce all the television coverage from the House. And then I like to think that I think there's no other comparable House and Senate staff that work so close on a daily, almost hourly basis than our staff and Senate Media Services TV staff to provide programming to the citizens. So that's a real brief rundown. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Representative,
yes, I'll make it very quick, Madam Chair. I appreciate very much the services that you do provide, and our citizens really do as well. You hear about it, I'm sure we all do, all across the state, and it's amazing how much that is watched and used. However, with this change from analog to digital, you know?
No, I said it's shocking how much
it is. Yes, it is. It's amazing. And at night and everything, and people work. But at any rate, with this whole analog and digital, there's a bit of an issue. You know, it's just kind of going along really well. But it's I'm hearing from folks, and they're not able to find it and some other things. I'm just wondering if, I'm sure there's an answer for that, and now that we've kind of hit that deadline, and I think once before there was an email that maybe explained it, but I think it was preemptive. Well, now it's happened, and people are really wanting to know more what options there are, where is it covered in analog, what do they have to do, digital, where is it covered in digital. Is it possible for you to kind of get a comprehensive message that we might be able to get out to our citizens?
Basically, in the Twin Cities metro area, we are, if you have a TV with rabbit ears and are receiving analog television, we're still on channel 17 over the air with the rabbit ears. Now, if you're in the Twin Cities and you have a cable company like Comcast or maybe Time Warner, their channel 17 does not have the legislative programming. And that's really an issue between Twin Cities Public Television and the cable company. Now, we have been broadcasting on a digital channel for, we're in the end of a second year of a contract. We actually did it 1 year prior to this. So we've been on this digital Minnesota channel for going on 3 years. So if you are able to receive digital over-the-air channels, generally we're on channel 396. So you may have cable, but you'll need a digital cable box to access those digital channels. And so it's not an easy explanation, and I did try to provide members with some kind of explanation prior to the original February 17th shutoff. And now that's been extended to June 12th, so we're still sort of in that transition period. Another thing to throw into the mix is if you receive your TV via satellite, the DISH network does not provide the Minnesota channel. I dealt with two calls earlier this morning about that. DirecTV says it's coming soon, but it's been coming soon for about 4 weeks. So, you know, we're just a program provider to the Minnesota Public Television Association. But it is important to remember that once this transition finally happens, and right now we're statewide, we'll be able to broadcast statewide on a digital channel. So if you have an over-the-air antenna and a digital receiver, you'll be able to get the programming from 8:30 until 6 every day. But it is a difficult transition for the industry as a whole, and for us as just a programmer provider that is buying airtime on these hip stations.
Well, Madam Chair, I really appreciate that explanation. Would you just mind maybe sending out, I know you've done some of it, you know, just send it out again and update anything whatsoever and all those kinds of things, or anything else you can think of that would help us to help our folks to address their issues, even segmented by, you know, some of what you just said, but that would be helpful.
Yeah,
because you do a good job, and people really, really like it.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, members, we will certainly do that. And as additional cable channels are added, we add those to the website where we list all the cable channels.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Oh, we just reminded that the next meeting is Monday, April 6th at 2:45 in 300 North in the State Office Building, and we'll be dealing with Phil
and then the next one, and then it's Tuesday at our regular time, also dealing with bills.
So Monday and Tuesday at
2:45. The Monday.
Yeah.
Okay. Meeting adjourned.